Excellent. The next case on the court's calendar this morning is Rogers versus Carpenter. Counsel, we're doing this by Zoom this morning. It's the same as if we were in court in terms of each side having 15 minutes to present their argument, and then appellant's counsel will get an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording this audio, not visual. So even though we know who you are and you've introduced yourself once already, please be sure to state your name for the record before you begin each leg of your argument. We'll now hear from counsel for appellant Mark Rogers. You may begin.
Michael Bryant, representing Mark Rogers. The issue here is that a summons and complaint was brought for legal malpractice on May 23rd of 2019. And the summary judgment's basis was that that was not within the 6-year statute of limitations. What's interesting in the court's order is that in the court's order that came back, he had no finding of facts, but under the court's order, under number 3, there's a requirement that the court looking at, I would submit all the case law, whether it's Antone or Hansen or any of the case law, the court needs to look at when was there damage, when was there some damage. And the court finds that the damage, that their problem that he ran into, that the damage comes when either Garbo, which is the other lawyer, left the law firm, and that would be in, I had that date here, that would be in 2016, or when the lawsuit was brought, which is 2017. Both those time periods, under the court's finding on damages, should have been within the statute of limitations. Now, the court found that, went back and said just that it was based upon the original date of an email that was sent back in February 14th of 2012, that was the date to go back to, but gave no findings as far as damages. And I would submit that's the difference between this case and all the other cases out there, all the cases the defense relies upon, all the cases that are out there, where the court does a specific finding saying, here's the date of the damage, that the damage date the court gives us is within the statute of limitations. Now,
Brian, I just want to stop you for a moment, because when I read your brief, the question I had initially was, what is the genuine issue of material fact that you're arguing here? And is this what you are claiming is the genuine issue that precludes summary judgment? Because it seemed to me your argument was more the thrust of, you know, what rule Minnesota applies with respect to accrual.
Yeah, that gets it. We get into other arguments and other ways that it could be looked at. But I start with what the court's findings are. And the court's findings were when the damage, and that's under number 3, when they go down that analysis. So that's where I started. My second thing I would rely upon is the affidavit. I mean, under MITSIC, we're required to have a affidavit. And the affidavit of Besser says the dates were either June of 2013 or February of 2017, again, both within the statute of limitations. So if we go to the affidavit, which is required, and for whatever reason, the court doesn't even talk about, and the defense completely ignores, the affidavit that we're required to have gives us the dates of causation, gives us the dates when there was damage, and gives us the dates when there was actually malpractice on the part of the defendant. The third place that I would look, that I think the court could look, is this argument that the defense made, which is interesting in that they say, well, the dates that it should be are either the February date or it should be the March date, that we could come up with the March date as a second option as far as the possibilities go. But what they ignore is there's an actual meeting on September 3rd of 2013, where the two parties get together and talk about these things. There's a dispute about what happened in that meeting, but there's a talk about these things that if you're going to go with the defense's argument that it's a floating date we can look at, you could look directly at the September 2013 date. So in either of those three ways, the way the court found it, the way it's found under Larkin's affidavit, or using the logic of the defense, all three of those gets us within the statute of limitations and allows this case to go forward. And if it's allowed to go forward, then summary judgment motion shouldn't have been granted. And that's why the Court of Appeals should send us back so that we can get to a jury and get this decided.
Well, I agree that with respect to the court's language, I mean, that paragraph is the only place that the term damages I think, appears. But I don't know that that as you read this order in its entirety, that that translates to some type of factual finding that the court was making. It may just be a function of loose language on the district court's part, it seems to me.
Well, the court is using the four prongs. So they're putting purpose to it because they're putting in each spot where you know, first they find that Mr. Rogers had a claim that could go forward. But in looking at the summary judgment motion, here's how we look at each of the prongs. And the third prong is damage. And the third prong is where the court puts in this. This is when they had their damage. They don't give us anything else in that order. There's nothing else in there other than just the simple date where they say, oh, here's the date. No reason for it, no support for it, no line for it. And even I would submit by the defense's response of creating this floating date, I think the defense realizes that there's a problem there because when you look at every single case that's out there, you look at Mitzik or you look at why am I blanking on cases right at the moment? But it, on Hansen, when you look at any of the four or five major cases out there, they all go back to a court finding that says, well, here's the date you had the damage. It's the date you got married. That was the damage date that triggers everything. It's the date that the tax return was filed. That's the date that triggered everything. The Besser affidavit gives us examples of why that's not the date, that this February 14th date is only a start. But there's many other areas, and according to Besser, it's June of 2013 or February of 2017, and that's where the malpractice is. Are there any other questions? Or
I'm also just, I'd like to hear your response to, because to me, this argument does seem very similar to Antone, where, you know, clearly the majority of the Supreme Court said that there was some damage as of the date of the marriage. And it seems to me there was some damage, you know, whether or not identified that way specifically or articulated that way by the district court order, there was some damage when this either memorandum of understanding or contract was formed and signed. And to me, the distinction between those two doesn't really matter here. I don't know if you're making the argument it does. But so as of that date, then some damage accrued because, you know, the pleases were put in place as to how the outcome would be determined if there was some type of firm dissolution. What's your response?
The Besser affidavit doesn't say that. I mean, what the Besser affidavit gives is that first argues that this isn't a contract on its face, that it's what in the end got called a contract because that was the only thing that was there. But this was provided with the belief that more was be done by Carpenter. And Carpenter did have, the defendant did have time periods such as the follow-up email that he got, then the actual meeting that they had face-to-face. He did have time periods where this is expected it was all going to be dealt with because Rogers wasn't the expert. And as much as the defense wants to make him the expert, and the defense is kind of arguing the malpractice was on Rogers' part and that they had nothing to do with it. It was just a contract. Nothing else could be done. Besser tells us that in June of 2013, clearly a business lawyer should have identified that there was a breach because the payments weren't made by Garbo. Or in February of 2017, that the actions at that point gives us the malpractice because, again, actions could be taken by Carpenter that would make a difference. And based upon that, I would submit that and then if you go back to the original court memorandum, court doesn't say that. The court doesn't give us some damages at that date, which is contrary to everything else. Because one of the questions to ask is if that's the date, okay, if we go and we say it's February 14th of 2012, that's the date that the malpractice happens, okay? Could Mr. Rogers even bring a lawsuit at that point? Could he say, well, you had malpractice and as a result? No, because he doesn't have any damages at that point. He doesn't meet all the elements that are required under the Anton case or under any of the cases or the case laws used by the court. Based upon that, submit it isn't till there is actually some damage that takes place. Now, what we have in a marriage situation is there is that point of no return. You don't have a breach in the middle of the marriage and you say, oh, we're really not married. Here, you had, according to Besser, a couple of different times where a competent business lawyer says, there's a breach, you can do something about it. And that would have had an impact and you wouldn't have had the damages, which eventually came to Mr. Rogers.
But isn't some of the damages when he joined the law firm?
I guess I don't think there was, because I don't think you'd have a viable lawsuit back in February of 2013. The idea that the defense is trying to craft is a response that says, oh, well, you had a contract. There's nothing else could ever be done. But there weren't papers that were drawn up. There weren't filings that were done. All things that in the past had been examples of the actions taken by Mr. Carpenter that weren't taken in this case. So I would submit that no, that there wasn't. And according to the Besser affidavit, that's not even where the malpractice. Well, there is malpractice, the idea of looking at this now and saying, oh yeah, that was a contract. That's just them trying to create facts so that they can fit this into a box. But if you take the facts as in the light of the plaintiff, and you take everything together, the affidavit, the findings by the court, and even the defense own argument, I'd submit that no, it's not until later within that 6 years.
Right. Any additional questions? Additional argument?
No, that's my argument, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from counsel for respondent again. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, good morning. Scott Jensen, Your Honor, here on behalf of Ron Carpenter. I intend to talk about the basic facts that indicate that there was damage on February 14th of 2012. I intend to talk about the two basic relevant Supreme Court decisions, Antone and Frederick. And I intend to talk about two Court of Appeals decisions that I think are instructive. The basic facts are these. Mike Garbo came to work at the Rogers Law Firm in 2008. And there was another attorney there by the name of Yuri Jelikov, who was there as well. They were very minor owners in this firm. There were discussions about how to bring these two gentlemen into the firm in 2010 and 2011. And Ron Carpenter was asked to prepare some documents to do that. He prepared very extensive documents, and those have been submitted to the court. They had everything from employment contract terms to termination provisions to provisions about delayed control. All of those things were covered. To the extent, too, that if one of the new people withdrew, what they'd get when they withdrew was $5,000. All of that was covered. Those are the kinds of things that are complained about in this action today as not being in the ultimate agreement. Jelikov left in 2011. And on February 9th, Rogers sends Carpenter a question, really, by email. I currently have 990 shares. Mike has 10. I want to sell him another 490. And he asks some questions. The very next day, Ron Carpenter gets back to him with some ideas. You might consider a note. You might consider security for the unpaid balance. You might consider a voting agreement. You might consider an arbitrator for disputes. And I mean, he got back to him right away. 4 days later, Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2012, Rogers has done his own agreement and he sends it back to Carpenter and it's signed by both Rogers and by Garbo. Carpenter has never seen it before. And it agrees to sell on three conditions. One, payment of $100, payment for half of the furniture, and payment or responsibility for signing up to be responsible for half of the file expenses for their cases, which were just on a loan at a bank. And it was a final agreement. It made them equal members. It made them joint owners, 50-50. How do we know that it was a final agreement at the time it was signed? For one thing, the arbitrator on the underlying case ruled that it was a final agreement right away on February 14th, 2012. Why was the arbitrator correct or right about that? These two people themselves treated it as final. It's important to our decision under Antone. The shares were transferred without restriction on March 22nd, 2012. There's an email from Rogers to Garbo 3 days before that, and it says this: Mike, you owe me $7,000 for the furniture. They considered it to be final. In the email from Rogers to Garbo on February 14th, the day this was signed, talks about an upcoming distribution of money. And it says this would allow Garbo to receive the $10,000 without withholding. In other words, profits. They're splitting profits and talking about it on February 14th of 2012. Profits were split immediately upon signature of this agreement. When we look at the company's information that was provided to the court for 2012, it says that they equally divided profits for that year. The year before.
Is it your point then, Mr. Jensen, that when those events occurred, Mr. Bryant's client could have sued your client for malpractice because there were damages at that point?
It is, Your Honor. Mr. Bryant talks about a floating date. What we've told the court is we think it was February 14th of 2012 and certainly no later than March 22nd of 2012. They started dividing the profits before that. The year before, profits were divided with $305 to Garbo and, or excuse me, $144 to Garbo, $305,000 to Rogers. In 2012, there's $110,266 of profits, and it's divided equally. Ron Carpenter's work from 2010 and 2011 was entirely thrown out here, and those are exactly the things that they're complaining about now. I think one thing is important in responding to Mr. Bryant's arguments. He seems to suggest that Mr. Rogers was waiting for, you know, other documents to be prepared, or that there was this assumption that other documents would be prepared. The court has seen Mr. Carpenter's letter of March 22nd, 2012. And the letter says this. It says, here's the shares. He prepared a share transfer certificate for each of them. And it's unrestricted. It simply transfers the shares to the new owner. And he says in his letter, he says, let me know if this is not okay, let me know if you have any questions or if you need anything further from me. It was pretty clear at that point that no other documents were going to be prepared. It was pretty clear that his work on this was over. I mean, really, this thing had been put together by Rogers himself with very minimal consideration, and nothing else further was going to be done. Rogers is the one who never responds in any way to that question. He never follows up. He never does anything else. I'd like to talk about some of the dates that were referred to by Mr. Bryant in his argument. He mentions the date of June 1 of 2013 as being a relevant date. The reason he says that is that this little agreement that Mr. Rogers drafted himself says that, you know, by June 1 of 2013, they're going to have put something together to share these file expenses. I want the court to know that my client didn't do any work at all in that June 1 of 2013 timeframe. This was not a memorandum of understanding. It was not something where Rogers was waiting for Carpenter to do more work. He did his work. He sent the shares. June 1 of 2013 is not a date that is important in this case or important under the Frederick decision. The other two dates that he mentions are much later in time. September of 2013, he mentions, interestingly enough, they don't mention it at all in any of their drafts of the complaint in this case. In September of 2013, there was a very brief meeting between Mr. Carpenter and Mr. Rogers, and it was about possibly selling Garbo a half interest in the building that the law firm was housed. And so they were talking about selling the building. There's about $70,000 worth of equity in that building. Ultimately, the building was not sold. Rogers just held on to it. The only thing that was talked about with regard to law firm business at all was that the name of the firm had been changed back in 2011 when Jelikov left. And he, ultimately, my client wrote to OLPR to advise them of that name change. It's nothing at all impacting this case. And there's nothing to make a separate claim under Frederick with regard to the September of 2013 timeframe. It's so unimportant that they don't allege it in any of their three versions of the complaint in this case. It's so unimportant that their expert that Mr. Bryant talks about didn't mention it in either of the affidavits that they filed, didn't mention it at all. There's no separate claim alleged or proven or shown or anything like that related to September of 13. By February of 17, these parties were already suing each other. Mr. Garbo left the law firm in December of 2016, and within a month, they were already in suit. My client didn't have anything to do with that. My client didn't represent anybody with regard to that. The only thing that my client was asked to do was to sign an affidavit. And he was asked to do this by counsel or by Mr. Rogers to sign an affidavit that said he'd transferred these shares on March 22nd of 2012. He signed a little short one-page affidavit that said that he had done that. And then he sent that back to them. He didn't send it to the other side. He didn't get involved in their litigation. He sent it back to them with those notes. In terms of the case law, there's some things that we know and we've known for 50 years. Minnesota has picked the middle rule with regard to the statute of limitations. So Minnesota doesn't go with the occurrence rule. It doesn't go with the discovery rule. It goes with the sum damages rule, and it's the middle ground rule. Herman versus McMinimy tells us that that's the standard that we're going to apply to legal malpractice cases, and the court has done that in every case that has happened since then. The most important case in our matter is the Antone case, and it's the first of the antenuptial cases. Antone hires an attorney to do an antenuptial agreement in 1986. He does it without protecting marital appreciation. The people get married in December of 86. The divorce started in 1998, so 12 years later. The question in Antone is this: does the statute run on the marriage or when the divorce judgment takes away some of Mr. Antone's property? And here's why it's important. In 1986, we don't know whether the values of his property are going to go up. We don't know if he's going to get divorced. It seems kind of contingent in Antone. And the Minnesota Supreme Court tells us that it began on the marriage. It clearly began on the marriage. And so what the court said was Antone lost the right to unilaterally change the consequence of the protection of the appreciation. The consequences were immediate and they were irremediable. He passed a point of no return without the legal shield of the antenuptial protection. That's what happened in our case. These two entered into a contractual relationship. They entered into a business relationship. They were 50-50 partners. They started to share profits. If they got sued, they were going to be responsible 50-50. It's the same kind of a relationship as the marriage in Antone.
Mr. Jensen,
yes,
what is your response to Mr. Bryant's argument that is focused so specifically on the district court's order and the court's use of the term damages?
Well, I agree with Your Honor that perhaps there was some loose language in that order. Here's what I would say about that. The court below very clearly ruled that the date of accrual was February 14th of 2012. And I think it's implicit in that ruling that there was some damage by February 14th of 2012. Certainly the issue had been entirely briefed and gone through. I think it's implicit in that. I think that the real answer to that question is this. This court is hearing this case de novo. It's a motion for summary judgment. Antone says that the court gets to look at that de novo. I think the court gets to look at all of these facts, regardless of whether or not that decision could have been more detailed. I think this court gets to look at those facts and determine, they're undisputed facts, determine that this case should be dismissed, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The two cases that I would, the Frederick decision, basically it's the second case that says there can be times when there are two claims, right? And so I think we know from the Frederick decision, that number one, Minnesota courts aren't going to go with this continuous representation rule that's talked about in some of the briefs, because otherwise you'd have no reason to have a rule about two different claims. And so the court hasn't specifically ruled one way or the other on it, but I think we can tell from that. When can there be two claims? I'm going to cut to the chase here. I've got a couple of decisions that I'd like to mention. One is Nash versus Gurovich. It's a case where there was an MTA that was done with no Karen waiver, meaning that the spouse could claim spousal support later by getting jurisdiction of the court. There's a situation where you have the bad stip, and you've got bad work in a trial court later. Clearly, there can be two different claims under circumstances like that. And there's other cases out there where there's a bad act that happens, and then later on there's litigation. Those can have two different statutes of limitation. Our case is much more like Compart versus Riley, where some property was transferred. It got screwed up in 2000. The old owners mortgaged the property inappropriately. In 2012, this attorney tried to correct it. And so the question is, if you try to correct it and you do some additional work on that, can that be a basis for a new statute of limitations at that time? And the court says no. We would basically, Your Honor, just ask that this court affirm the sum damages rule, that it continue to reject the continuous representation rule, find there's no separate claim under Frederick, and affirm this dismissal.
We are ready for rebuttal argument. Do you have any, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. The reason why I use those dates, I use the June date, is because that's in our expert's affidavit, which is required to go forward with the case. And that, when you look at it, is a good affidavit. It's based upon the facts, and it should have been used by the court and should be used at this point and should give us get us beyond summary judgment. The reason we use the September 13th date is because that's in response to their floating date, where they've come up with two dates and then they stop. We can look at the September date also under their same analysis, and we dispute the facts as they claim that they say. They say nothing was talked about. We dispute that fact. It's in our affidavit from Mr. Rogers. And based upon that, we submit that that's a fact issue that should go forward. Beyond that, when we look at the case law, I'll look first at the Anton case and the anti-nuptial agreement. Now, what's interesting is the lawyer was hired to create the anti-nuptial agreement to say, if things go bad, here's what's going to happen. Okay. The issue here isn't with a divorce where someone gets married and you can somehow have a breach. That doesn't happen. That isn't a circumstance with a marriage. You either are married or you're not married. You're either married or you're divorced. You can't look at it and have a breach. According to our expert and according to our affidavit, the malpractice came at two different points where Mr. Carpenter didn't tell him, here's a breach, we could do something about it in 2016, or in 2013. And in June of 2013, or in February of 2017, were both opportunities where something could have been done that is akin to the anti-nuptial agreement, in that the lawyer who's relied upon is being asked, here's an opportunity to help us, to fix us. Doesn't do that. They want to blame Mr. Rogers for everything. They want to-
Mr. Bryan, I agree. You're either married or you're not, but in your case, your client either joined the law firm or he didn't. So why, could you respond to Mr. Jensen's arguments when he discussed the things that were done at that time in relating to sharing of profits, issuance of stock certificates, et cetera, et cetera? Why? I mean, I thought that was rather convincing as to some damage. Why is he wrong?
Because that's what Mr. Rogers wanted. He wanted to have the partnership. That was the idea. He wanted to have the partnership. Where he was relying on Mr. Carpenter is, what happens? What's the problem that we need to protect against if this thing goes bad? And that's what
that's the same thing with the anti-nuptial. I mean, if you know, what happens if things go bad? Well, things went bad in that one, and you know, things went bad here. But it seems to me that, you know, if he gave your client bad advice, you know, in terms of structuring up, you know, what goes bad when he joins the law firm, that's when some damage occurred, i.e., why didn't you, you know, why didn't you not have an arbitration clause? Why didn't you, you know, give me double recovery or you know, liquidated damages or all the other things? I mean, why am I wrong?
Because, well, I think you're right, Your Honor, but I think you're right in the rubrics or looking through it on the affidavit of our expert. Our expert points out when those dates are, when he did something wrong. It isn't like the Anton case where the lawyer made the anti-nuptial agreement. Here's the date. Here's when he made it. So it was in place and something could happen there. That was the damage. What happens is Mr. Rogers says, I need this help. Doesn't give him the help, relies upon the time periods that goes by, meets with him within the statute of limitations. And our expert's affidavit says, this is the time periods when there was actual malpractice, where he didn't do the things he was supposed to. Beyond that, I would submit, what's important is what's in the court's findings. When you look at the court's findings, they use the four standard texts, which is from Fredrickson. And number three is important. That's the one in all the other cases, the appeals court looks back at and says, well, what did the court find as the damage date? And they find some damage. We can't create that. And the date that they put under number three is the date is either 2016 when Garbo leaves or 2017 when the lawsuit commences. Those are all in favor of the plaintiffs and reasons why this case should go forward. So I don't think you're wrong. I just think how you apply it as to there is no such thing as an anti-nuptial agreement in this case where Mr. Carpenter did this on this date and you look at it and say, oh yeah, that's when he created. That's the big difference. I think, am I out of time? I think so. I don't see my clock going anymore.
Looks to be. All right. And are there any other questions from the panel members? No. All right then. Thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute. And that concludes the hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.